I want to welcome all of our folks on YouTube and everybody that is here and everybody that is going to be part of what we're doing tonight. And AJ, did you get that? Okay, thank you. And so if you have a question tonight, just fire it into us. Otherwise, we'll be, you know, we got some questions here. Also questions on the floor. Before I get started tonight, if I could get a little help here. Right after Bible study, you can hang around for a little bit, but I need to get, hopefully, the same guys or some guys, right after we go, we need to go over to Steve Brackeen's and put those grills back and get the tents put up. Who can go help me with that? Anybody here? Josh can? Anybody else? John Bisquette can? Bobby can? Anybody? I need probably one more. Anybody else can go help me? Caleb. Alex will go. Okay. Well, I'll let you know, and you'll have Caleb, too. Good. I'll let you know when we get ready to do that, and we'll get out of here, and we'll go from there. We'll go from there. All right, let's get into our Bible tonight. Appreciate you being here, and I got some good questions here. Let's start off with one here that probably everybody wants to know. About one way or the other, you're probably at some point in your life going to be faced with this. The question has to do with getting together a living will. And a living will, you know, within that, they're going to ask you all kinds of questions. And one of the questions that they're going to ask you is that if you go to the place, like say you had a heart attack and you or stroke or whatever, and you're incapacitated, and you're on a ventilator, or you're on some kind of life support machine, the question is, you know, how do you answer that? Being a Christian, how do you? And honestly, it's a thought-provoking question because, you know, it can throw a monkey wrench into, or it seems that it can throw a monkey wrench into some of the principles. And, you know, and I guess the question that you ultimately ask is when do you pull the plug and pick them off life support? And that's a question probably at some point everybody is going to have to deal with, probably. And it's an honest question, and it's a very good question. And let me just say this to you starting out. There is there are some things when it comes to your life that you have a right to decide. And obviously, this question is a great question, but unfortunately, I can't go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, pull the plug verse. There's no place in the Bible that covers this directly, and you're faced with, the issues that they didn't have back in the Bible times, and when people died, they died. There was no medical proficiency like it is today to actually keep people alive, maybe even after they're already dead, by just pumping their bodies with oxygen and keeping them on. And so, you know, but here's the key, and this is what you want to remember. Even though there is no direct place you can go, there are principles that will cover the overall aspect of it that you can follow. And if I was faced with a situation like that, here's what I would do. First off, I don't want you to feel that if you follow my advice anyhow, I don't want you to feel that you have, later on down the line, that you have, you know, you killed that person. And what happens many times is that we start second-guessing what we do. And that can be, the devil can use that, and it can be a problem. So you wanna remember that if you follow the generic biblical principles here, there is no. Now, if you're writing a living will, here it is. If you're writing a, let me cover this first. If you're getting a will, a living will, and on there, in there, they ask you, do you want yourself to be jump-started if you die? Do you want to be on a ventilator? Do you want that? You have a right to answer that either way. I mean, that is your choice. You're not violating any biblical principle by doing either one. And it's a thing where, modern medicine today, and this is another thing you need to understand, modern medicine today, its whole goal is to get life expectancy for people to live longer. And so that's what they do. So they will go to the nth degree to keep somebody alive, even though the situation is terminal, to give you as much time as they can. Now, I'm not fighting that, and that's fine. And this is not a criticism of anything. These are things in real life that you are faced with. And, you know, at that point, when you're doing out your living will, if they say to you, do you want to check the box if you want to be put on life support or if you want to be brought back if you code versus just letting it take its natural course? And, you know, I get it. Some Christians will say, well, you know, I'm just going to really be a great Christian and let God take his course. Somebody else would say, well, I'm just going to get on a ventilator and see what they can do. Neither one of decision is wrong. That's a personal choice. I would never begin to intrude into matters that is between you and the Lord and what you have to do. Because, you know, either way, it's okay. It's your personal preference of how you want to go out. You're going to go out. So it's not a question that you're going to do it. So let me give you the principle that's involved here. First of all, you've got to understand that modern day medicine is given to us by God. It's part of the equation that God put into the world. I know people who, you know, and I meet them all the time, who are against doctors. They get into, they won't go to see a doctor. They won't go to a doctor. They believe that, the plants and herbal things are what you need and all you need to fix any problem that you have. And let me just address that for a moment. I understand and I agree that the plant life or the things that we have incredible ingredients that that I think can help. I have no questions with that. The problem is you got to have a balance in it. And the Lord knew that, and Paul knew that. And, you know, it's a thing where Paul carried with him a licensed physician, Luke. And, you know, it was a thing where, so he recognized it. You got to have a balance in the middle. I've known people that honestly, and this is, you know, and this is not a criticism. It's just an observation of seeing how sometimes in most cases, people's convictions don't go all the way to the end. And I never listen to what somebody tells me about, oh, I'm against medicine, or I'm against doctors, or I'm against hospitals. Everybody has to make up their own mind. But I'm going to tell you something. In every case that I have ever known where somebody took that position, which is an okay position, when they got so bad, they wound up in a hospital. Now, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. In other words, you're against it up to the point that you really need it. And there are some things you need a doctor for. I mean, that's all there is to it. And you got to find the balance. If some things that you can take that are herbal things and help you, I'm all for that. And I believe that is true. I really do. But I also think that you have to have a balance with it. And it's a thing where there are some things that when I say that, I knew a lady here 30 some years ago who was one of the sweetest ladies you ever met in your life, and she had what they said was terminal cancer, and the doctors did everything that they could do for her, and basically said that there was nothing else to do, that she was on terminal and she was going to die. Well, And I don't know how she got all this together, but she went to some hospital down in Mexico and that dealt with herbal, whatever things that they do. And this was 35 years ago, and they go through with cleansing and all this stuff. And all I can tell you is this. She's still alive. She's married. She has kids. And something worked for her. So I'm not fighting it. I'm just saying, you find some guys that they're totally against it. Other guys are for it and against the other. Hey, you got to be in the middle with it. So you got to understand that, first of all, God will give and use physicians in your life. And whatever degree balance you want to choose to be, again, that's your call, not mine. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you, you know, what you got to do. I am just telling you the principles, the general principles involved here. Now, so when it comes to a living will, you have a right to check any box, no box, both boxes, write your own box in if you want to. It's a thing where, you know, Colonel Sanders did that, Kentucky Fried Chicken. When he died, he checked in a box and wrote he wanted to be buried in a red and white striped casket, and he was. So you can write in your own, whatever you want. They put their chicken in red and white striped boxes, in case you didn't know that. Anyway, so it's a thing where that's your call. Here's what you got to look for when you have a loved one, mom or dad, husband, wife, brother or sister, that's on a life support. The first thing that you do is you get the medical opinion from the doctors. Now, you don't go on that alone, but you got to have all your options. If he tells you that they're already terminal and there's no chance they're going to come out of this and be normal again, or then that puts it into a context that you have to, you have to work with. If somebody's had a stroke and they're in a vegetative state, and the doctor says there's no brain activity, obviously the machines that we have today can pump you and keep you going even after you're dead. So I get that. Here's what you got to follow. Here's the principle I would follow. One phrase, quality of life. You have to assess where that person's quality of life is at this point in time. Now, here's another factor that comes in. And I, again, this is not a criticism. This is a fact of human life. Sometimes when it's a dear loved one, we don't want them to go so desperately that we overstep the bounds of keeping them when, if they would have had a conscious choice, they would have said, let me go. And that's a problem we face. And again, that is not a criticism. It's just a human fact of life. Sometimes we want to keep that person when and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it becomes a selfish thing. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I totally understand that. Nobody wants to lose a loved one. But the reality is there's appointed unto men once to die and after this to judgment. Ecclesiastes says there's a time to be born and a time to die. And it's going to be a thing where sooner or later they're going to have to go. So the first thing you look at after getting in a medical evaluation that you can understand is then you've got to judge on your own the quality of life. Now here's the kicker. And this is where some people, if the doctors tell me one thing and I see that the quality of life or the no quality of life matches up to what they're telling me, then I feel good with either going either way. If I, at that point in time, I would be okay with, because, you know, here again, the key phrase that everybody does, well, I don't want to keep them on life support, you know, because that takes it out of the will of God. Not necessarily. But there comes a point when the quality of life issue clearly defines itself that at that point you got to say, okay, God, you know what? I've done everything I can do. The doctors have done everything they can do. We've come this far. And at the end of the day, they belong to you. And if you want to take them home or you want them to recover, and that's in your plan, a life support isn't going to make difference one way or the other. And then you can put that in God's hands, completely knowing and understanding that that is the right thing to do. have them taken off the machine and then just simply say, okay, Lord, they've always been in your hands, but I have used the things that you gave me in this life. But now I'm at a point where they're not going to work anymore. Thank you for giving me those things, but I'm at a point now where it's just in your hands. So I'm taking it out of the medical world that you gave me, and I'm now putting it into your hands because you're the only one from this point on, and it isn't me deciding whether they're going to live or die. You're going to decide if you're going to take them home or you're going to bring them back. And when you do that, you see, if God really wanted them to come back, there's no danger in you doing something that is going to hinder that. You're not going to override God's hand in the thing. But you got to exhaust in a balanced way everything that you have at your disposal. But there comes a point when you've got to walk through that valley of the shadow of death with God, and you got to simply say, okay, there's no quality of life here. There's nothing here. So I, you know what, this is what I'm going to do, and now it's totally in your hands. Now, I'm going to give you an example on this, and this is going to sound like I'm making a comparison to one and the same, and it's not, so just listen to me. I have the same struggle when you have to put a good dog down. You get attached to your dogs or cats or whatever. You get attached to your animals, and it's a thing where they become part of your family. And I'm not equating that, you know, the death of a mom or a dad or a brother or sister is equal to a death of your dog. I'm not saying that. I'm just, listen to me. What I'm saying is you have to make a decision. And I struggle with that. I've come to the place where I have taken my other lab, my yellow one, Daisy One, she was having all kinds of problems, and you know, it was a thing where she had a huge lump on her shoulder that was obviously a tumor. And I took her to the vet fully understanding that I was probably going to put her down that day. So, and I had prepared myself for that. And I went in there, and he looked at her, and he says, yeah, he says, that's what it is. And he says, now, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I guess we need to put her down. And he says, well, you know, here's the thing about dogs. Dogs are unique animals because they will simply go till they can't go anymore. And they'll never complain about it. They'll just go till you find them one morning when they can't get up and they can't go anymore. And he says, she's bad, but you might be able to get, if you want to, 2 or 3, 4 more months out of her if we put her on this medicine. Well, you know what? I'm going to go the distance. I mean, she went the distance with me ever since I had her. So I'm going to go the distance with her. And that may sound stupid to some of you, but you know what? I feel sorry for her if you can't relate to this story. So it's a thing where, yeah, you know what? I got another 7 months out of her. But then one day, she started to lose her bowels. One day she couldn't get up. One day she couldn't move anymore. And I knew at that point, there was no question in my mind, that the quality of life was gone. Now, I told you that story not to make a comparison, but I told you that story to build it around the idea of a quality of life. When you see in your loved one that the quality of life is not there anymore, you have to decide, do I want them to stay so badly that I'm going to make them a fruit salad for the rest of whatever? Or do I put it into God's hands and say, you know what, Lord, I've done everything that you have told me to do. I've used what you have given me, and now I'm at a place where I can't do this anymore, and nobody else can. So now it's a point in time where it's really in your hands, and you're going to make the decision for me, because I don't want to make that decision, because I know that life and death is in your hands, and it doesn't relate on a life support system. So that's how you got to handle it. So, you know, as far as checking the box or doing what you're doing in the living will, you have a right to do whatever you want to do. If you want to go on life support, then and you want them to do that for you, then I would give them instructions. Or if you have a family member, give them instructions, you know, how it's going to go, what you want to do, how you want it to play out. And then, you know, just follow that that line of reasoning, and you know, you can't go wrong with it. There's no easy answer to it, and there's no direct verse on it. It's a thing where what you're seeing is the reality of life and death. So even though there's no direct principle for it, the overall principles, this is a good example of how you can use the overall principles to come to a decision without actually having a book, chapter, verse place. So anybody got any questions on that, that you, you know, if you're doing your own living will and you want to check the box or whatever? I, you know, then there's a sad side to it. I've seen, and this is, I don't, this is not to be funny, but it's kind of funny. I've had situations where, one in particular, where the kids hated the mom and just hated them with a passion, and they didn't get along, and she was on life support, and they tried to call the kids together to go up and say goodbye to her, and they wanted to take a vote over who got to pull the plug. I mean, that's, yeah, I know, that's, you shut up, you don't laugh at those things. It's a thing where it's tough, man. I mean, you fight all kinds of scenarios. You gotta try to pastor through that with somebody sometime, you know. So it's crazy. So anyway, anybody got anything on the board back there? Okay. Anybody got one here? Yeah, AJ. AJ's going to do his wife's will, and he wants to figure this out.
My question's at the end of Hebrews.
Hebrews?
Yep, the very end.
Where at?
It's not a verse, but I have a paragraph mark in my Bible, and I just had a question about what it says.
Hebrews what?
13:25.
Hebrews 13:25, you mean where it says, "Grace be with you all, amen"?
Yeah, I just have a paragraph mark in my Bible right underneath, and it says that it was written to the Hebrews from Italy by Timothy, and I know in Institute you were saying that the book itself was written by Paul. So is that paragraph mark in reference to chapter 13, or when did Timothy write something in Hebrews?
Well, somebody else asked me that question, and, you know, it's a thing where Paul didn't always write everything he wrote personally. It was dictated, and somebody else wrote it for him. You see, you know, in Acts, you see that the same thing. So I would say that it's dealing with the last chapter. There's no question about that. And we talked about that in Institute. It's dealing with the last chapter, and I would simply say that Timothy, if Paul was in jail, ready to die, that Timothy probably was, he was there at some point, probably dictated to Timothy, and Timothy got it out. It's probably what you got. Somebody else asked me that question right after Bible Institute, so that's a good question. All right, the next one is in, another one here? Okay, up here. Pam.
No, I'm not. Proverbs 30.
Proverbs 30. Chapter 30. Okay, hang on. Let me get there.
30. Verse 21 through 23.
Proverbs chapter 30, verses 21 through 23.
Yes.
Okay, it says, I'll read it. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four which cannot bear: a servant when he reigneth, a fool when he is filled with meat, an odious woman when she is married, and a handmaid that is heir to her mistress.
Yeah, I was going to see if there's any way that this lines up to doctrinally, like what's going on in government today, like the four which cannot bear, would that be the squad, the four women in the Congress? And the servant would be Obama?
Yeah, you know, when I originally taught this through Proverbs, and this is a great question because this will show you, you know, there's such a thing in the Bible as progressive revelation. And none of the Bible scholars and none of the pastors believe that. Ruckman talked about progressive revelation. And what progressive revelation is that the Bible continues as we move through history. The Bible continues to reveal itself on the same level that we're at in that century. And you see that, you know, I would say probably nobody, when World War I happened, nobody saw probably, I've never read anything on it anyhow that anybody did. I read it after the fact of 30, 40, 50 years. But I've never found anything written during that time or right after that time that anybody ever saw World War I for anything other than World War I. And when World War II came around, you know, again, it was years after that that I saw anybody again, and I found nothing going back trying to find it, that anybody saw World War II other than the historical perspective that in Europe, Germany and England fight about every 120 years. And it was a thing where nobody ever really tied it all together. But when the Jews became a nation, and you understood Matthew chapter 23 and 24 with the budding of the fig tree, then those events that happened in our history suddenly get revealed through the scripture that nobody saw 200 years ago. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the Bible is a living book, so it continues to reveal itself and give revelations about things that we see based on the things that have been written. And so that's a thing where, and this is a great example of that. Now, when I taught Proverbs back when we did Proverbs in chapter 30, which was quite a while ago, you know, everything was totally different than it is today. And when I taught that back then, look at verse 21. It says, for three things the earth is disquieted, and for four which it cannot bear. Then fundamentally, there's four things here that are going to destroy the earth. And when I taught it based on the information that I had, which is 100% accurate, at the time. And I taught at that point the servant when he reigneth was Obama because of that concept in the Bible. When I said a fool filled with meat, I made that the false churches with bad doctrine and the neo-evangelical crowd and even the Baptist guys and the churches out there that have bad doctrine. The odious woman, and the word odious means hateful, I connected that to the Roman Catholic Church and, you know, ran it back to Jezebel. And the handmaid to her maidens, I ran that back to Hagar, the Egyptian, and Sarah, who was going to bring about the promised seed and all of that stuff that you had there. Now, that is 100% bona fide, right on the money. But as things move on, you see the book keeps revealing itself. Now, I don't know what you know about Proverbs chapter 30, but everything in here is dealing with the tribulation period or right before the tribulation period. When you get down here in verse 24, and it talks about the four things which are little upon the earth, then the ants, the conies, the locust, and the spider. I walked those back for you and showed you that this is definitely in the tribulation period. The ants, and I'm not going to take time to get it all laid out tonight, go back in the tape. The ants will be the 144,000. The conies would be the Jews, because that's a rabbit that lives in the rocks, and the Jews in the tribulation run into Sela Petra or the rock city. The locust hath no king. That will be the plagues that you find in Revelation chapter 9, Isaiah 32, and Joel chapter 1 in the tribulation. And then the spider, And I gave you the references to that back in Psalms 45, 15 and Isaiah 56, 6, is the Jew that takes hold of the new covenant and holds fast in the king's palace. So all of that is in the tribulation. There's no question about it. Now, who would have ever thought, I wouldn't have, that little more than 2 years ago from today, we would be where we're at in not only the world, but certainly our country. And our country is at a place where right now we are at the door of the tribulation period. There's no question about that. And so, again, as events change, you begin to see how it works. I'll give you another example. I don't know if you remember or not. Some of you were here. Most of you probably were not. But about 9 or 10 years ago, you remember how I took, I don't remember, I think I did it on a, I don't know when I did it. It took me a long time to do it on one night. But I took the judges in Israel and judges, and I matched them up to the same amount of prime ministers that Israel had. And I showed you how that even the women lined up together from the Old Testament to this. The way that the guys conducted themselves of giving away land worked on both sides. It's one of the most phenomenal things that you'll ever see. And we laid it out and compared each one judge in the Old Testament and matched it up to a prime minister. And I showed you that the last judge was Samuel, who brings in, he doesn't bring in, but comes in during that, after him or with him comes Saul, who's a type of the Antichrist. So when we went through our study, I showed you how that each one of these prime ministers, if they reign twice, then you only count them once. You can only count the ones that knew, because it doesn't happen that way in the Old Testament. You've got to match them up one-on-one. And I told you back then that there was one more that was going to come in that was going to line up and be a good guy. And then there was going to be another one down the line someplace that would be the last prime minister that last up to the last judge. And during his time, the Antichrist would come in. Now, the next guy that came in had already been in before, so he wasn't a new guy, was Netanyahu. He has been in now all of this time. But it looks like, as of maybe next week or the week after, he's going to be booted out, and the next prime minister is going to come in. And if that holds true, what we saw in Judges, he'll bring in the Antichrist. Now, who would have gotten that? Who would have understood that 100 years ago? But you see, God keeps opening up the book, revealing revelations as things change around the world that we don't miss it. Because he told us in Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 45, he told us that he was going to tell us and show us before God's judgment comes. So if you're a Bible-believing Christian, I know no man know the dayeth and the hour. I get that. But I'm telling you right now, if you're a Bible-believing Christian, and that's kind of a loose term, let me put it this way. If you really have your Bible down, you're going to probably be able to read this thing pretty much right up to the finish line. Now, having said that, verse 21, 22, 23 gets a whole new dimension to it. It still deals with what I'd laid out doctrinally, but now it's all changed again, because now Obama stays Obama, and he says there, for a servant when he reigneth, and then he says a fool when he is filled with meat. That will be Biden. Meat in the Bible is doctrine. You know that. And doctrine, or the word doctrine, isn't just associated with the Bible. Politics is a doctrine. Somebody asked me this question a couple of months ago or so, and they wanted to put the fool that hath the fool when he is filled with meat wanted to make that Trump. And I told him, I said, that looks good because both of them are fools, but it can't be Trump, and I'll tell you why. Because Trump was never filled with political doctrine. He was a newcomer. That's why they didn't like him. That's why they hated him. He didn't spend his whole life in politics. Joe Biden has been in it almost 50 years. He is filled with the meat. So he fits that. Then, if you want to go down the line, verse 23, for an odious woman when she is married, that would be our vice president. And then if you want to make to go all the distance, then it says, and a handmaid that is heir to her mistress. And that would be what we call the squad in Congress, the four or five Muslim ladies who are totally against Israel, who want to turn this country against everything with Israel. And this is what you have, and I want you to know, you can say what you want to say. I'm not telling you to believe it. I don't really give a flip. But I'm telling you this, verse 21, 22, 23, take place before 24, 25, and 26, 27, and 28, which is the tribulation period. So go pound sand. Because they're connected together. And I understand and firmly believe that as I taught that before, you know, it stands doctrinally. But now, in less than 2 years, who would have thought that America would be where she is at? As fast as she has come down, which gives a whole new understanding when you read something like this, and yet every one of them fit into what we're facing today, and then the next set of verses takes you right into the tribulation period. I mean, you can do what you want to do with that, but I am telling you right now, this is what the Bible does, and I'm not being dogmatic about it. I'm just telling you that it matches up. You take that plus the judges of Israel, and it's on the website back there someplace, isn't it, guys? It is? Yeah, it is, Jenny? Okay, it is on the website. You got to listen to it. And then you can make the leap from way back then to where we're at now, because if they boot him out and put this guy in, if it lines up and stays true to what we have in the book of Judges, this guy's going to bring in the Antichrist. And it's incredible. Now, having said that, this will lead into my next question that was sent in this week, or really it was last week, in Genesis chapter 5. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 5. You get all this stuff tonight, you won't want to put yourself on a ventilator machine in the living will. Now, her question is concerning the days of Noah and the days of Enoch. And she wanted to know what exactly was there a correlation between the two and what they do represent. Now, this goes right along with what we've already seen. And I'm telling you right now, everything in the Bible at this point that has any kind to do with prophetic stuff toward the end of the world, it's right there. And you are seeing it. If this world can go another 20 years without, I don't know how it can. I just don't, maybe it can, but I just don't know. So, her question is, can I elaborate or explain on the days of Enoch versus the days of Noah? Well, let me just say this to you first. And here again, this is the same scenario that you just found in Proverbs chapter 30. The servant that reigneth and the fool with much meat and all that stuff was right before the Jew in the tribulation period. And when you come to Genesis chapter 5 and 6, you have the exact same scenario. Now, the days of Enoch, and we'll get into those here in a minute, but let me give you what they are first. The days of Enoch will be a picture of the last days of the church age. Because Enoch, verse 24 of chapter 5, walked with God, and God and he was not, for God took him. Enoch is a type of the rapture. He's a type of the church in Hebrews chapter 11. He's very clearly a great type of the church, and this whole story here is a picture and a type of us being taken out by Enoch being taken out. And then we have over here in chapter 6, 7, and 8, and 9, we have Noah and the flood. Now, where Enoch represents the church in its final days and then is raptured out, Noah represents, again, the tribulation period. Turn back to Isaiah 54. And look at verse 7, 8, and 9. Now the verses that I'm about to give you in Bible study, serious Bible study, this is called association. You associate one thing with something else. Now look at verse 7. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies I will gather thee. That's God talking about the nation of Israel, that in the church age he has forsaken them. When you go back to Matthew chapter 13 and many other places, you'll find that God in the church age, because of their rejection, hides himself from the nation of Israel. So that is the, for a small moment have I forsaken thee. That small moment is about 2,000 years in God's mind. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. Now that gathering is not the second coming of Christ, as most guys would teach it to be. The gathering has to start around the end of the 1800s with the Zionist movement up through World War I and up through World War II, and then God gathering them back, and you'll actually find places back in the Old Testament that we don't have time to go to tonight that shows them Jews being burned in the ovens at Auschwitz and Dachau and those places, and God using that to get them back. So the gathering started back around, I would say, with the Zionist movement. And that takes place, way back in the end of the 1800s, and then escalates into World War I, and then moves into World War II, and then, of course, they become a nation in 1948. So that is God beginning to gather them. Now, I believe what I'm about to say, and I teach this based on what I've learned from the Bible. We know that in 606 BC, we entered into a time period called the Times of the Gentiles. And the Times of the Gentiles are basically the time that God now is finished with the nation of Israel as a ruler of the world, which he was. And now her going into captivity and God turning the world over to the Gentile nation. So that's where you find then in Daniel chapter 2, the upcoming places. And when you get to Daniel chapter 7, then you find the last three, which is Russia, United States, and England. Or really, England, Russia, and United States. And so you find all that times of the Gentiles. Now, as far as I am concerned, and this is based on the book of Esther, the only book in the Bible outside of Song of Solomon where the word God is not found and no reference to God in any way, shape, or form. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason why there's one book with no God in it for the Jew and there's one book with no God in it for the church. I'll let you figure that one out. But the book of Esther, you find that behind the scenes, God is orchestrating everything to bring about the nation of Israel back to where he wants them to be. And I would probably say that in God's mind, I know God lets things play out and there's always a transition. God never stops one thing on Monday and does something on Tuesday. I would say that it certainly by 1917, in God's mind, the times of the Gentiles were over, even though the times of the Gentiles are still folding themselves out, but God now is turning his attention to the nation of Israel, because in 1888, 1900, Christianity dumped the Word of God and God was done with them. So I would say is what you're seeing around you today is nothing more than an apostate Christianity, other than a few pockets of Bible-believing churches sprinkled through this, you know, this mess. But the reason why there's nothing going on, because there's no Bible and nothing can go on without a Bible, and God now has turned his attention, other than what he's doing in the lives of individuals and churches who are holding the line, he's turned his attention away from the Gentiles, and he's focusing on the nation of Israel, and you can see that right now. America will turn against the Jew. We're already seeing it bend that way with the wind that's blowing. And in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, it's the way it's going to go. Now, I know that, and I'm just going to be a little bit of a prophet here, if you allow me to be that. I mean, you can be whatever you want to be. I want to be a prophet. You see, everybody right now is banking on Trump becoming the next president next time around, because he's got millions and millions and millions of supporters out there. Now, I'm not for or against Trump one way or the other. I'm going to tell you why that's not going to happen. And I don't really, it didn't matter if he did or he didn't. I'm going to tell you why it's not going to happen. I mean, it's just as simple as that. And it's not going to happen because that's not in God's plan. Now, here's what you're going to have. You can mark it down, and you can come back 2 or 3 years from now and buy me lunch. Tell you're sorry. Here's what's going to happen. We get to the next elections. The Democrats are already padding the slate. Why do you think they're opening up the borders and allowing all the illegals to come in? Why do you think they're doing all those things? And I'll tell you why. Because they're going to fix the voting thing that all these guys can, all these illegals can vote. And who are they going to vote for? End of story. At the same time, what you're going to have is the fact that when the Republican Party comes up in the next general election for the President of the United States, they're going to be divided. Because there's a lot of people that don't like Trump. And there's a half the people that do like Trump. Let me just say this to you. You can't win an election with half the people. It ain't going to happen. They have went after him. Do you ever know of a president in the history of the world, of our world, of America, that in his 4 years in office got impeached twice? And he absolutely did nothing wrong in either case? Now, the New York prosecutor is going to bring him up on criminal charges. Why are they doing that? Because they don't want him to run the next time around. They want to do everything they can. Once the Democrats, and here's the cards on the thing, you poker players, here's your hand. Once the Democrats got in power, they're not getting out. And it's going to take this country right up to where God wants it to go, and bring in all the events that God wants it to have to bring about where God's end is and where we're going to, what's going to happen. It's just the way it's going to be. So it really, when you look at that thing in Proverbs 30, it really, really, now that you see where we're at, boy, I mean, I they're firing a teacher down in South Carolina, saved man. One of the nicest guys, clear head on his shoulders, certainly isn't a radical, but he's going to get fired out of the public school system because he refuses to address fifth graders, third graders, fourth graders, sixth graders, seventh graders. If they're a boy and they feel like they were shortchanged at birth and they want to be a girl, he won't recognize that. And they're going to fire him. It's only the beginning of what's coming. And, you know, when I grew up, the great movement was the hippie movement, and all the Baptists were against the long-haired hippies. And when a hippie would come into a church and says, with long hair, you know, hair of a woman, and he'd say, do you have a bathroom? The deacon would say, yeah, we've got two. Which one would you want? Male or female? See, we're way past that. We're way past that. We're at the place now where they're telling your kids in school that if they don't feel like they were a boy and God made a mistake and they should have been a woman, that they can identify with that and change their sex, and now that's who they're going to be, and they want to be recognized as that. I'm telling you. I told you Sunday, this guy who's wants to defund the police. We was in Chicago last week. He's given this deal of you know, defunding the police and taking this and taking their guns away and taking their authority away and suing them for this. And while he's giving this speech, two kids steal his car. They were sixth graders. How does the kid must have watched that Harrison Ford movie, Indiana Jones, where that little Korean guy put those big blocks of wood on the pedal so he could steal the car. And you know what? Here's America. First, and then the guy didn't press charges. See? Didn't press charges. And it's a thing where, oh, the news media is all over it, and they're all running up the flags, you know. Well, this is, you know, we need more education for these kids. Well, these kids, you know, are being introduced to crime. And these kids, everybody asked the wrong question. If I was in that thing, I'd have stood up and I asked one question. Where was the parents? Why weren't these kids in school? Where was the parents? But you see, we don't want to talk about that. This country is gone. And it is not coming back. And I'm telling you right now, you're seeing what's happening around you. The coronavirus is going to look like it was a day at Worlds of Fun. We have the weakest government in the history of this country, other than maybe Jimmy Carter. And it's a thing where Russia, you know what you do when you want to attack somebody? This is military 101. If I've got a group of guys here and there's a bunch of people over here that I want to attack and I want to wipe them out, I'm not going to go in with a frontal assault or attack and do it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to send out some recon probe elements. And I'm going to probe their defenses. I'm going to find out how many guys they got, what's their weapon status. I'm going to find out how they're deployed. Do they have any armor? Do they have any artillery? What am I up against? And how, if I attack them, what can I expect in retaliation? And if you think Russia is not probing us at this point, they shut down the pipeline. They shut down the country's biggest meatpacking place. Nobody told you they shut down the transit system in New York with the subways in April. And they attacked Martha's Vineyard and shut down the shipping, all through the cyber computer stuff. And it all goes to the Russia or the Chinese. Everybody knows it's the Russians. Vladimir Putin is nobody you'll want to mess with. He's a hardliner. He's looking at America as a joke. And he's probing America like a guy sticking his finger into a fat guy's belly, seeing where the muscle is. And he's not finding any. And it's a thing where he's probing to see what America's going to do. And he's doing the same thing that Adolf Hitler did. Adolf Hitler was satisfied with Germany, so he just moved out and took the Sudetenland. And when he took the Sudetenland, Britain, France, and them had alliances, and he didn't do anything. So you know what he did next? He took Austria. Nobody did anything. You know what he did next? He took Czechoslovakia. Nobody did anything. You know what he did next? He took Poland. And nobody did anything. It wasn't until he invaded France that they got involved, but it was too late then. You know why? Nobody did anything. Hey, the old saying, evil triumphs when good men do nothing. And boy, I'll tell you what, Putin is a hardliner. He was head of the KGB before he became where he's at. He was in the Spetsnaz, which is the special forces of the Russian, before he did that. And, Russia only knows one thing, only respects one thing, brute force. You don't negotiate with them. You don't parley with them. If they hit you with a hammer, the only thing they appreciate and respect is you hitting them with a bigger hammer. They will push you. You know what happened in 1961, 1962, with the Cuban Missile Crisis? The Cuban Missile Crisis down in Cuba? You know what Russia did under Khrushchev? You know what he did? He parked about 40 CBM interballistic missiles 90 miles from Florida on Cuba's soil, staffed them with Russian technicians, setting up missiles that were nuclear missiles that if they fired it toward Washington, D.C., and they lifted off that thing, the people in Washington, D.C. would have 3 minutes warning before it hit. They could hit any place in continental United States within 8 minutes, farthest being Oregon and Washington State. He parked them down there to see if he could get away with it. Now, back then, we had a president, President Kennedy, and he, if you haven't ever seen the movie 13 Days, you got to watch it. It is probably the most accurate, clearest representation that went on. And I lived through that. I was in grade school. I mean, I remember the night that was all going down. My dad thought we were going to war, and we thought we were going to go to war, because they were not going to allow those missiles to stay there. And Russia and America went eye to eye, and Russia blinked, and they took the missiles out. But they wanted to just see how far they could go, because if you don't stop them here, then they're going to step out here like Hitler did. And if you don't stop them there, they're going to come here. So where are we going to stop them? St. Louis? And we don't have the government in place to stop them. I mean, all Putin is going to get when they meet here in a month or two is Biden's going to say, would you please quit? It's all he's going to get. And if I was president, we'd probably be in a war by tomorrow. But you know what? War is good. We need to wipe out the population a little bit anyhow. I'd have put the 7th Fleet on notice, boy, and I'd have found out where those guys that hacked those places are, and I'd have took those places out. But they won't do that. No, they won't do that. Putin is a hardliner. He's trying to bring Russia back from the grave where she was at. I'm going to use the word greatest, probably the worst, under Joseph Stalin. And Joseph Stalin took over in the late 30s and was up to about 1955 when he died. And he was a holy terror in Russia. But he built Russia through the Cold War and up to the Cold War as the menacing nation that, brother, you don't play with. You don't negotiate with them. You don't try to have a fun time with them. You don't think any agreement that they give you, you don't believe it. They only know one thing, force. They only respect one action, force. And when you push them, when they push you, you have to push back harder than they push you. They'll respect that. We're not there anymore. And what is going to happen? What is going to happen? I'm a prophet. I'm telling you what is going to happen. You're just seeing the litmus test. You're just seeing the small probes. One of these mornings you're going to get up and your electric's going to be off. They're going to hit the power grids. Could you imagine what would, just in, 2 weeks of the oil going down there, the gas lines? Can you imagine if they shut it down for 6 months? How about if they hit the electrical grid and all of the things and your cell phone don't work, your computer doesn't work anymore, your car won't start? It's coming. It's exactly what they're going to do. And only thing we got barely to defend ourselves in Washington is harsh language. Because we won't do anything. But that's God's plan, you see. You need to understand that. This is God's plan. America's done. So enjoy it. Put a happy, smiley face on your face and starve to death. You're going to die. It's just the way it is. I don't know what to tell you. It's not going to get any better. Nobody's going to fix it. You got the UFOs showing up now. They're going to bring everything in just what you want. We're going to talk about that a minute in chapter 5 here. And the sons of God are all right around the corner. They're probably at Quick Trip waiting for to get a phone call to show up. But this is where it's going. America's done. And it will only be a matter of time where you will have to decide where you're going to take your stand. Now, let's look here at chapter 5 a minute, and let me put this thing into some kind of terrible context for you. Give you nightmares tonight. Now, here's what you got. She asked if there was a correlation between the things here. Let me show you, first of all, what you got. Now, we got Enoch here, and it says up here that, let's see here, verse 21. It says that Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he begot Methuselah 300 years and begot sons and daughters. Now, the way this verse lays out, it illustrates probably that Enoch wasn't walking with God before Methuselah showed up. And then when Methuselah came into his life, there was something about that boy that changed Enoch's life. Now, I don't know all the conversations that they had, him and God, but I do know this. The name Methuselah means, when he is gone, judgment shall come. So, whatever Enoch's conversation was with God that we are not privy to because we don't have it all, it changed his life based on that boy, that from that point on, Enoch knew God was coming and God's judgment was going to come, and Methuselah was the key. So, it says here, verse 22, and Enoch walked with God after he begot Methuselah 300 years and begot sons and daughters, and all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. So God came down and raptured out him and took him out. He's a picture of the church. He had a definite protocol of when God's judgment was going to come. Look at Isaiah 42. Back to Isaiah again. Pick it up in 7. To open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and to them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. You see that? That's what he did with Enoch, with Methuselah. And I'm telling you right now, God is going to show anybody who's got any kind of relationship with that book what's coming. It amazes me that the COVID-19 hit Christianity, even in our own church, to the extent that it did. It only proves to me that nobody listens to me because I've been preaching that for the last 15 years, what was coming. And I'm telling you now, and, you know, nobody's listening to me now either, a few of you maybe. But anyway, now watch this. And Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech. And Methuselah lived after he begot Lamech 782 years and begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. And Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son, and he called his name Noah. Now watch this. Watch how God systematically uses the events of years. He has Lamech, Methuselah, when he's 189 years old. And then Lamech, in verse 28, when he's 182 years old, he has Noah. So that brings our time frame up to 369 years old, Noah is. And in Genesis chapter 7, verse 6, Noah was 600 years old at the flood. So you take 187 years, 182 years, and 600 years, and it adds up to 969. The flood came on the exact day that Methuselah died. Now that's just serious Bible study, believing what you got, showing you what you have. Now, where Enoch, and here's where it gets tricky. Where Enoch is a picture of the you and me as a church getting raptured out, and we know when that time is going to come within reason because of the fact that God will tell us before he springs it on us. When we get into Noah, Noah is a type of the Jew in the tribulation period. And I already gave you that in Isaiah 54:9, that the time that the waters are on, did I give you that already? The time that the waters are on the flood or on the earth has to do with God dealing with the nation of Israel in the tribulation period. So we got Enoch representing the church. And we got Medicare wanting to sell me, give me a breathalyzer to keep me alive. Anyway, so Enoch represents the rapture of the church, and then we have Noah coming in. Now, here's the kicker. And I'll be honest with you, I don't really know how far to take this. And please don't run up here and tell me you got it figured out, because I know you don't either. But I don't know how far to take these two types. If Enoch is a type of the church, how far do I take that? And the church goes out right when the flood comes. Then there were sons of God here when the church was still here. The sons of God are around in Enoch's time. Now, I don't know how far to take that type. Some types, you go all the way with them and they fit. Some types, and I've told you this before, you got to be careful with them. And that's my dilemma here. There's no place that I know for sure how to push that. But I'm going to tell you this. That would give credibility to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago about the fact that some guys do teach that the first 3.5 years when Christ was on this earth was the first 3.5 years of the tribulation period, and it's already been passed. And when this rapture takes place, it kicks off the Great Tribulation. That's what happens here. What happens here, on the day Methuselah died, the flood came. The flood is not the first 3.5 years of the tribulation period. The flood is the Great Tribulation period. But I don't know how far to take that type. I don't know how far it can go. But I am telling you this. In Enoch's time, those sons of God were here. Now, with everything you're seeing going on in this world, everything is rushing to a focal point here. Our hatred for Israel, the demise of every moral fiber of our country, the country going down the tubes as far as going to destroy everything about anything and make this into a socialistic / communistic country. The other nations out there laughing at us and probing us and pushing up that's going to come in and can shut down everything that we do in the day of life. And you see, there probably will not be any World War III's like there was a World War II and a World War I. The next war that's coming will be a cyber war. It'll be fought on a keypad. And it'll be a thing where, you know, that's where who wins and loses. And it's a thing where America, the greatest thing I can say about America that is absolutely true down through history is one phrase, a day late and a dollar short. America traditionally in the last 150 years that I've been around, but I've been looking at it, always comes in second place. We came in second place in World War I. We came in second place in Pearl Harbor, World War II. We came in second place in the Cold War. We certainly took last place in Vietnam. And we never learn. And now here we are, the greatest supposedly nation on the planet with the greatest technology that you could ever want. And we're going to get whipped again. Except this time, and maybe all the times it was, it's in God's hand. So right now we're seeing all the focal points, and the icing on the cake is now that the UFOs are about to make their appearance. And now our own government is admitting that they have lied to us for all those 70 years. Again, you know, this comes as a surprise to many people. And, you know, I get emails and things from everybody out there, 40 or 50 a week, you know, like this is some new revelation. I taught this stuff 40, 45 years ago. And I told you everything that is happening now. And I was a prophet then. I'm still a prophet now. And I'm telling you, once you learn how the things go in the Bible, you know how they're going to go in future. And this thing has been set us up, and we are ripe, ready to go. And it's going to be just like it was in Genesis chapter 6. Now, the only question is, how much of that do we get to be part of? And I don't know how far to take the type. I don't know how far to stretch that thing to put it all in place. And I have my own personal feelings on it. And I wouldn't be dogmatic to you. My own personal feelings on it, you take the type all the way to the end. That's my own personal take on it. But I wouldn't tell you to do that. And I wouldn't get up. I'd always give you the alternatives and always tell you, you know, that, you know, there may be something here. But this thing it scares me to the point that of where we're at. And I don't mean scare me in the face that I'm afraid. It just scares me to the point that it's happening so fast, I would have never believed it. I would have never believed in the course of 2 years America could go down the tubes so quickly. But it has, and it's everything, it's unbelievable to me. Everything is correlating around everything that we know for the rapture of the church to be imminent. And you know what? It may not be imminent. It may be the fact that, you know what, we're going to go through some things before we get to that point. And God's people are much like America. They're always unprepared. And it'll catch everybody. And it's a thing where, you know, I get an email from a guy wanting to know what he should do with his church. Should we start stocking up on food? Should we start buying weapons? Should we start buying ammunition? Should we start preparing for the anarchy that's going to... And there wasn't one thing that he... I don't care about it. I think that's good. Get some food. Get some freeze-dried cheeseburgers that you can melt in water and put in the microwave. You won't have any power, but whatever. Get you some ammunition and a good gun so when they come over the front room, you can take the last bullet for yourself and end it all. I get it. I'm all for that. But these guys said not one thing about stocking up on biblical principles. You think food, guns, bullets are going to override the principles of the Word of God? You ought to be storehousing in your own house right now. But we don't think about that. You know why? Because we're unprepared. For us who claim to be Bible believers, when push comes to shove, the last thing we ever think about is the Bible. And that's a tragic thing, but it's so true. And God's people will fall apart in a big way. You know, like I said, the coronavirus was only the test case. It showed anybody who's paying attention where Christianity and God's people are really at. And there's a joke. It's a joke. And it's a thing where, and I know, they try to justify it every way they can, and I understand, and I get it. Hey, some of them were old and needed to stay home. Some of them had older grandmothers or mothers and that, and you need to protect them. I get that. I understand that, totally. And I'm really not fighting anybody. I am just telling you, there's a lot of them out there that just turned chicken. And they just didn't want to put it on the line. And it was easier to play safe. And I'm not saying that the coronavirus, going through it and taking a stand, would have prepared you for this. There's going to be no comparison. But it shows you where everybody's at. And, you know, and I'm not into any, come on, I love all of you. I really do. More than you ever know. But come on, I'm not under any illusion. This thing hits the fan, man. We'll probably call roll call in a phone booth. I mean, I love you, man, I do. And I've done everything I know how to do. But at the end of the day, now I base that on? Jesus had 12 that he spent 3 years investing everything he had in them, and when push comes to shove, he only had one left. It's the way the wind blows, see? So yeah, you can see there's a real correlation here between Genesis 5 and Genesis 6, ties into Proverbs 30, that everything, the earth is disquieted, the earth is being tore up, everything and those things. 2 years ago, I would have never put it into that mindset. I would have taught it doctrinally like I do, which I still would. But advanced revelation, God opening up and showing in the scriptures, things that were written that now have a dual application, you might say. And once the events of our time begin to unfold more, then you go to, that's why you keep going back to the book. The revelation of God, the Bible's a living book. The revelation of God didn't stop when John wrote Revelation. It goes on and on as the Holy Spirit of God reveals things to us. It's God's mind. So if God knows what he's doing in his mind, then it's in that book. And God just has to reveal it. But the reason why nobody sees it is because nobody pays much attention to it. It's just a good book. Well, I got a King James Bible. Well, praise the Lord. What do you know about it? And it's a thing where it becomes a real problem. And it becomes a real issue. So you know, that's what you got. So we'll hold up there and